presentation is going to have somewhat more astronomical phenomenology that you might be used in this cosmology seminar. And so if that's the case, do ask me questions and to expand on my claims. And it's okay if I have to truncate the presentations if it helps making it clear. So I want to begin by just introducing two key observations in galaxy formation that really motivate this work. And they both have to do with the inefficiency of star formation in the universe. The first observation concerns the inefficiency of star formation within individual galaxies. And it's an observation that's called the Kennicott-Schmidt law, after two of the authors that study this relationship observationally. It's a relationship between the star formation rate surface density in galaxies and the gas surface density. So it's a relationship between the star formation properties of galaxies and their gas content. And the problem comes about because there is the simplest theoretical idea for how rapidly a galaxy should be forming stars. And it is that the star formation rate of a galaxy should be of order the gas mass in the galaxy times the characteristic time that it should take gravity to pull that gas together. We call that the free fall time in the galaxy. And that simplest theoretical idea, which involves only gravity, is roughly indicated by the solid red curve here. But what we find in reality is that galaxies are turning their gas into stars at a rate which is only 1 to a few % times that. So that the data point are 50 to 100 times lower than the gravity-only prediction. And so we would like to understand why this dimensionless number, the mass fraction of gas in galaxies that's turned into stars per free fall time, epsilon FF, is of order 1 to a few % as opposed to order unity. So understanding that is one of the fundamental problems in star formation today.
So in gravity only, this also depends on the thickness of the disk.
So this curve is makes an assumption for the thickness of the disk. It assumes that the gas disk is the thickness of order, I think, 50 parsecs. Yeah.
Is that number measured empirically, or is it calibrated from these semi-analytic n-body codes?
So this is what's measured, and the puzzle is why is this of order 1% as opposed to order unity? Simplest theoretical model that people thought about decades ago would have predicted that this number. Well, in cosmological simulations, it is often a parameter that is introduced as a way to model star formation on unresolved scales. But one of the advances that I will highlight at the end, if I get to the last part of my talk, is how we are now trying to directly predict this in cosmological simulations rather than put it by hand, as has been done before.
But wouldn't be prediction if you already know the answer.
True, but at least we would like that number to be an outcome of a calculation that starts from more general principle rather than one that's prescribed in the calculation.
Is there any dependence on the type of spiral, quantum spiral that you might design?
Not really. So this is the observed relationship, and the main parameter really appears to be the gas surface density in the system. There is some scatter. I am not aware of a strong dependence, systematic dependence on, say, the normalization of this relationship on the properties of the spiral structure.
Is the property of the spiral structure
reflect the kind of feedback that's What are the spiral structure
reflect? The property of the spiral structure,
as far as I know, not really. As far as I know, the spiral structure is more of a reflection of either gravitational instabilities in the disk or instabilities that are, or perturbations that are excited by passing satellites or dark matter substructure, things like that. Although this is not an aspect that I am confident about. What's that? Perhaps to a small degree in detail, but I believe that I believe that if that effect is real, that it is very secondary relative. Yeah, sure.
Are we allowed to take a 1 minute timeout from the topic? I'm very curious to hear how you got reading. There must be some sort of.
Because I was interested in feedback and documenting the structure. the point is that in some galaxies, the spiral structure is primarily stretched in a star forming region, so primarily stretched in blue light as opposed to red light. And in other galaxies, that reflects patterns of big dark. And I was collaborating with some people in chemistry and biology.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I'd like to hear about that. That's something I'm less aware of. Okay, so this is a sense in which star formation is inefficient on the scale of individual galaxies. There's another sense in which star formation is inefficient, and it's a more global one, and it is the following. So this is an observational inference of the mass fraction inside dark matter halos that's in stars inside galaxies within the halo, as opposed to thin gas or dark matter, as a function of mass of the dark matter halo. And that's an inference that's valid at redshift of zero, and it comes from a technique known as abundance matching. And here the point is that this fraction peaks in dark matter halos that have a mass similar to the one that holds the Milky Way at a value that's only about 20% of the universal baryon fraction, omega B over omega M. Whereas if all the gas had been converted into stars, that number should be one time omega B over omega M. But most importantly, that fraction is far, far below the universal baryon fraction, both at the low mass end and at the high mass end of the galaxy mass function. And it turns out that this is, in principle, a problem that's independent of the Kennicott-Schmidt law from the previous slide, because even though star formation inside individual galaxies is slow relative to a galactic freefall time. A galactic freefall time is, in general, much shorter than the age of the universe, so that most galaxies should nevertheless have had time to turn most of their gas into stars. Yet this has not happened. So solving the first problem does not guarantee that you've solved also this one. Nevertheless, I believe that there's likely to be, to a great extent, commonality in the solution to these two problems in what we call feedback from stars, in particular at the low mass end of the mass function. And I'll talk more about this in this presentation. We think that feedback from stars really does not provide enough energy to solve the problem at the high mass end of the galaxy mass function. And that's why models often appeal to feedback from massive black holes in addition to star formation. And I might say a few words about that too. So the next two slides are simply just very broad introduction to what we call feedback. So feedback just refers to the fact that when you form new stars, so when you grow a black hole, that process can return significant amounts of energy and momentum in the surrounding gas, and that can strongly affect the subsequent evolution of the system. In particular, when you have a burst of star formation, the most massive young stars emit copious amounts of ionizing radiation, which can both heat the surrounding gas as well as directly push on it via radiation pressure. Young stars also drive stellar winds that directly interact with the ISM. And finally, after a few million years, the most massive stars explode in supernovae. And that's one of the main mechanisms through which stars stir the surrounding gas. And that's just a picture of a star-forming region in a nearby galaxy, the Large Magellanic Cloud. And what we see here is a cluster of young stars that's driving a bubble of expanding dust and gas. And we have some quantitative understanding of the energy and momentum that's returned by each of these main stellar feedback processes, embodied in this case in a stellar population synthesis model known as Starburst 99. And these stellar feedback processes collectively do two main things, we believe. The first one is that they drive turbulence that's observed in the interstellar medium of galaxies, including in our own Milky Way, but also winds on the scale of entire galaxies that are directly observed from essentially every highly star-forming galaxy in the universe now. This is one of the most famous examples of a galactic wind. It's around the Starburst galaxy M82 in the local universe. The green light here traces stars in the galactic plane, and the blue and red gas is being expelled of the galaxy to a combination of supernova explosions, stellar winds, and radiation pressure. And this is just to illustrate the dynamic range of star formation rates over which these outflows have been measured, so from dwarf galaxies to some of the most highly star-forming systems in the universe. Okay, so I want to now move on to some new science results. The first part of my talk will address the first problem that I outlined, that is the inefficiency of star formation on galactic scales. So I will present a model for the origin of the observed Kennicott-Schmidt law. One of the points that I will emphasize is that the rate-limiting step for star formation in galaxies is the rate at which the most massive gravitationally bound clouds form in the interstellar medium. These are objects that I call the giant molecular clouds. And that's important because these can be directly resolved in our best cosmological hydrodynamical simulations now. And this is what is allowing us really to make significant progress in predicting star formation in a fully cosmological context in this type of simulations. I will contrast the prediction of our theory for feedback-regulated star formation with a competing class of theories in the literature for what explains the Kennicott-Schmidt law, known as supersonic turbulence models. I will argue that these are now in significant tension with observations, actually. If I have time, and this is a part that I might skip if I am short on time, I will say a few words about recent observations of galactic winds that are not driven by star formation, but really by central luminous black holes. In particular, I will argue that these outflows are in the energy conserving limit. I'll explain what that means and argue that this provides an explanation for the very large momentum fluxes well in excess of L over C that we have inferred of them. And I will conclude by introducing a new numerical simulation project that we call FIRE. It stands for Feedback in Realistic Environments. And this is a project that really aims to model both star formation and stellar feedback in a much more physically predictive manner than had been done in this field before. Okay, so I want to start by discussing a model for the origin of the Kennicott-Schmidt law in galaxies. And the next few slides will just walk through the main argument between that model. This slide being intended primarily to introduce the quantities that will appear over the next 2 to 3 slides. So what we have is a galactic disk shown here in which new stars are being formed. This disk has a thickness little h. It has a mean gas density rho bar. And very importantly, because these are the quantities that appear in the Kennicott-Schmidt relation, it has a gas surface density, big sigma g, and a star formation rate, surface density, sigma dot star. And what happens is that as new stars are forming, they inject momentum in the ISM via stellar feedback. And that drives turbulent eddies in the ISM. The strength of stellar feedback we quantify by this parameter P star over M star, where P star is momentum and M star is the mass in stars that's formed. So this is the momentum per unit stellar mass that's formed, returned in the ISM. The characteristic velocity of the turbulent eddies on the larger scale we call V turbulent. And the basic physical postulate here is that these disks are in vertical hydrostatic balance, that is, the turbulent pressure that's driven by stellar feedback equals the gravitational weight per unit area of the gas in the disk. Okay, so that's the main postulate that we are making. So the first thing that we want to do is evaluate what this turbulent pressure is. Okay. In steady state, it has to be that the rate at which turbulent energy is injected in the ISM equals the rate at which that turbulent energy is being dissipated. Now, the energy injection rate per unit volume is simply this term, so that's the star formation rate per unit volume, times P star over M star, that converts that into momentum injected per unit time per unit volume, times the characteristic velocity of the turbulent eddies that are being excited, which converts that into an energy injection rate per unit volume. Now, by definition, the turbulent energy dissipation rate is just the turbulent energy density divided by the time scale over which it's dissipated. And we know from a variety of studies of turbulence, including in numerical simulations, that that's approximately a crossing time of the largest eddies. So it's the size of the largest eddy, which I've assumed is equal to the disk scale height divided by the characteristic turbulent velocity. And these equations are sufficient to solve for the turbulent pressure, the answer being that it's over the star formation rate surface density in the disk times P star over M star. And just notice that it has the correct units and scales as you would expect. That's right. So, yeah, that's correct. So most of the energy, though, is in three-dimensional turbulence is stored in the big eddies. So that's, it may actually be more, I'm not positive whether this relies on the turbulence being in 3D, but it is definitely the case in 3D that most of the energy is stored in the big eddies. I know that the energy cascade proceeds differently in different dimensions. That's why I said 3D.
What is the characteristic time for the cooling of the cooling? So once this energy cascade to the smaller scale,
yeah,
it should also start to cool spiral.
Right. So I'll come back to this, I think, on the very next slide. That is, I will make some assumptions. And one of the assumptions is that the density in the gas is sufficiently high that it can be assumed to be fully molecular, and that's essentially equivalent to assuming that the cooling time of the gas is very short compared to the other characteristic timescales in the problem. And that's actually realized in relevant systems.
What were P star and M star?
So big P star is momentum that's returned by stellar feedback, so the collective effects of supernova explosions. And M star is the mass that you form in new stars. So P star over M star is the momentum that you return in the SM per unit stellar mass formed. So it quantifies the strength of stellar feedback. Okay.
And I realize now that another way to say that you answer my previous question is that the idea is that the injected energy there you got in is being injected into the largest guys.
Yes. Correct.
The rest of the cascade is changing by an overall factor, what the time was for the first cascade. But the whole staircase.
Right, the rate limiting step is really on the largest scale. Okay. So we know how to evaluate the turbulent pressure. And so what we want to do next is equate that with the weight of the disk gas per unit area. And so this is the assumption that I just referred to. So in this work, we focused on galaxies that have a gas surface density above 100 solar masses per square parsec. So these are galaxies that are actually significantly denser than the Milky Way. The Milky Way has a gas surface density of order 20 solar masses per square parsec or so. And we did that for a number of reasons. The first one is that in the Milky Way, the interstellar medium is quite complicated. It has a clear multi-phase structure with hot bubbles inside of which molecular clouds are found. But if you go to galaxies that are sufficiently dense, the cooling time of the hot gas is actually quite short. And to a good approximation, the interstellar medium can be assumed to be molecular and nearly isothermal. And so the medium is just simpler to treat analytically. So neglect in particular molecular chemistry. Now, it is nevertheless an interesting regime. It is relevant to the nuclei of local merging galaxies, so-called ultra-luminous infrared galaxies, or ULIGs, but also very importantly to ordinary star-forming galaxies at higher redshift when the gas mass fractions were higher and when the star formation rates were elevated relative to what they are in the local universe. And that's, in fact, perhaps the regime in which most stars in the universe have formed. And furthermore, in this regime, there is one stellar feedback process that dominates turbulence driving in the interstellar medium, and it is supernovae. For supernovae, we actually know how to calculate quite accurately what P star over M star is, and that comes from models of supernova remnant evolution. And the answer is the following. It's about 3,000 kilometers per second, and it depends very weakly on the ambient density in the galaxy. So to first order, for order of magnitude estimates, this is a constant, and it's about 3,000 kilometers per second.
But that depends on the initial mass function.
Yes, so the two main ingredients in this calculation are the initial mass function in stars that tell you the number of supernovae per stellar mass formed. So that's a calculation that's valid for a standard Chabrier IMF. And then the other ingredient is a model for supernova remnant evolution that tells you per supernova what's the momentum.
Okay, but what's the reason to expect that you have same initial mass function everywhere if you have different environments? Presumably, IMFs could be different.
Yeah, so there's some evidence for environmental variations of the IMF now, but this would change the answer at the order unity level. So it has not yet been incorporated in our theory. That's something that could be done in the future. But recall that the factor that we are trying to explain is a factor of 100 or so. And in these slides, I'm presenting the order unity theory. At the very end, I will show you numerical simulations that attempt to model the same physics but relax many of these simplifying assumptions. Okay. Now, the weight of the disk gas per unit area is actually quite simple to evaluate. It scales with the Newton's constant and the square of the gas surface density in the disk. And so we can now equate this with a turbulent pressure from the previous slide. And this directly yields a relationship between the star formation rate surface density and the gas surface density. And it yields this prediction without any free parameters. Here, the only thing that I have suppressed in this expression is a dimensionless prefactor for the unity, for simplicity. And P star over M star, as I said, that's not a free parameter. That's something that we know how to calculate independently. Notice, by the way, that the normalization here is set by a ratio which quantifies the strength of gravity, big G, and another number that quantifies the strength of stellar feedback. Yes?
Do you consider also dark matter in the calculation?
Yes. So it turns out that this looks like it neglects dark matter because it only involves sigma G. But this is valid even if you have dark matter and stars that contribute significantly to the gravity. And the reason is a little bit subtle, but the reason is that the exact expression is slightly more complicated than this, and it involves a power of the so-called Thumri-Q parameter. But whenever the Thumri-Q parameter is of order unity, which means that this disk is in a state of marginal gravitational stability, then that factor that I have not written out explicitly here is also of order unity, and this expression holds in general. So in other words, yes, this prediction is valid even if a significant fraction of the gravity, vertical gravity, is provided not by gas, but by dark matter or stars. Yeah, I'll explain that next. And so this plot actually shows observations of the same galaxies as on the previous slide in the local universe in blue and at high redshift in red. The solid black curve here is the theoretical prediction. That's not a fit to the data. It's really just plotting what that prediction is. It applies to galaxies that are both in a state of merger and non-merging galaxies. And the reason, though, that the slope here appears steeper than it is on the previous slide is because what's really measured in observations is not the gas surface density or even the gas mass. What's measured is the intensity in carbon monoxide emission. And that is an optically thick line, which means that it's not, in general, a faithful tracer of gas mass. So one has to multiply this CO intensity by a factor that's called the XCO factor to convert it into a gas mass. And that we, it's really an uncertainty. We don't know how to do this accurately in general. That number has been calibrated observationally in the Milky Way, and it's also been calibrated observationally in extreme galaxies, the nuclei of merging galaxies in the local universe, the ULUGs. And in those two different environments, the XCO factor is different. Now, what the authors have done here is actually assume that for all galaxies, XCO is what it is in the Milky Way. And so that gives you a slope for the relationship. What I have instead assumed is what I believe is a slightly more physically motivated prescription, which is that I have assumed that for galaxies that have a gas effect density equal to that of the Milky Way, that the relevant XCO is the one that we infer in the Milky Way, and that for galaxies that have a gas effect density characteristic of ULUGs, that the relevant XCO factor is the one that we infer of ULUGs, and that for other galaxies, the relevant XCO is something in between, and I have just fitted a power law in between those two points that are known from observation. And it turns out that this simple fit to anchor to two data points agrees very well with recent radiated transfer calculations that attempt to predict the dependence of XCO on gas effect density in galaxies. And if you do that, the slope of the Kennicott-Schmidt law that's observed in this regime of gas effect density is actually 2 in agreement with the model prediction. Okay? Now, there is another way of stating the model prediction here, and it is in terms of this dimensionless number, epsilon free fall, the fraction of the disk gas mass that's converted in stars per free fall time, the number that I introduced on my first slide. And in this theory, that dimensionless number is set by the ratio here of the numerator, that's the product of the gas mass fraction in the disks, the fraction of the mass that's in gas versus the total, which can include dark matter and stars, times the circular velocity in the galaxy that quantifies the depth of the gravitational potential. So the numerator really quantifies the strength of gravity acting on the gas. And the numerator is, again, this P star over N star that quantifies the strength of stellar feedback. For typical galaxies in the local universe, the gas mass fraction might be of order 10%. The circular velocity might be of order 250 kilometers per second. That's what it is in the Milky Way. And so the numerator is of order 25 kilometers per second. And P star of M star is about 3,000 kilometers per second, like I said before. And this ratio is of order, therefore, 1%. And I think this is really why galaxies are converting only about 1% of the gas mass in stars per free fall time. Now, notice that this is not a universal number. It really scales in a well-defined manner with the properties of the galactic disk, in particular the gas mass fraction. And this solid curve here is this model prediction, simply plotted in a different parameter space that is good because it involves only quantities that are directly measured from galaxies. The vertical axis is a star formation rate of galaxies, and the horizontal axis is a combination of parameters that has the same units. And the fact that the data points, the observed galaxies, are agreeing well with the model prediction means that real galaxies have an epsilon free fall that really scales with the gas mass fraction in the disk. And the reason I emphasize this is that it's a prediction that is unambiguously different from the prediction made by competing theories of the Kennicott-Schmidt law, so-called supersonic turbulence models, which appeal to our understanding of the small-scale properties of supersonic turbulence, and which predict that epsilon FF should be a nearly universal constant of order 1%, and that it should not vary from galaxy to galaxy. This is a class of theories in particular described and advocated by Mark Ramos, Chris Mickey, and a number of other authors since.
So how much does epsilon change across the spectrum that you
saw? By about a factor of 10, 5 to 10, yeah. And that's that most of that variation really comes from the gas mass fraction, because for distant galaxies, the circular velocity from galaxy to galaxy, that doesn't vary by much more than a factor of 2. But the gas mass fraction varies from about 5% to 50%, about an order of magnitude.
Are there error bars on these
plates? No. Well, there are definitely observational uncertainties, but we don't understand them very well. We don't understand them very well because they are they are dominated by systematic effects, in particular by our limited understanding of what the correct conversion from.
How big could they be and how much could they change?
So my best estimate for what the total observational uncertainty is simply the scatter at these points.
How much would that change?
So this is not a fit. This is really what's predicted by the model.
Yeah, so that's the material.
Yeah, that's right.
So using that scatter, what's the best fit
slope? What's the range of slope that would be allowed? So it's easier to actually look at it in this parameter space, because that's where the exponent really comes from. So I think it cannot, well, okay, I think the uncertainty in the slope is really that the slope is between 2, which is the one that is supported by this way of converting the CO intensity to gas mass, and 1.2 to 1.4 or something like that, which is what you get if you assume that XCO is instead constant from galaxy to galaxy. So I think this really brackets the range of plausible slopes of the Kinnikot-Schmidt law. But the point that I would emphasize is that although there is some uncertainty as to whether we are predicting the correct slope because of that, we are explaining a factor of 100 in normalization, which I think is the more unambiguous success of this theory. So this global hydrostatic balance principle, I think, I have presented evidence that it is indeed a fundamental principle behind the observed Kinnikot-Schmidt law. But I have implicitly assumed that galactic disks are in smooth, steady states, whereas we know that in reality, star formation in galaxies is very clumpy. In the Milky Way, in particular, about a third of the current star formation occurs in only 33 giant molecular clouds, and that's illustrated by the clumpiness of the ionizing radiation that we observe from the galactic plane. These GMCs are really the most massive catenationally bound clouds in the ISM of galaxies, and so they have a well-defined characteristic mass, actually, and it is a characteristic mass for gravitational instability in disks. We also call that the Thumri mass. It scales with the disk thickness squared and the gas surface density. In the Milky Way, that Thumri mass, that product, is about 1 million solar masses, and that's in fact comparable to the most massive GMCs we observe. But that number can be quite a bit larger in high redshift galaxies that are both more gas-rich but also a significantly thicker disk, and in fact it can be 1,000 times higher than it is in the Milky Way, up to 1 billion solar masses or so. And in those galaxies, we in fact observe giant clumps of that mass scale. And the reason that I emphasize these masses is that they can now be directly resolved in our best cosmological hydrodynamical simulations. And that's significant because in our physical picture, the formation of those most massive gravitationally bound clouds is really the rate-limiting step for star formation. In particular, what happens is that stellar feedback drives the turbulence that keeps disk in a state of marginal Kraft-Natschnow stability. And that is what throttles the rates of formation of new GMCs by setting the probability with which turbulent fluctuations can become self-gravitating. That is, the probability that the Tumorec parameter locally dips below 1. And that is what ultimately throttles the rate at which stars form inside GMCs so that the galaxy is in global hadrostatic balance and lies on the Kennecott-Schmidt law.
Do you mean like strangles and stuff? So like throttles like a motorbike and makes it go faster? You mean it makes it go slower or faster?
Slower. Sorry, right? Because when the disk is, when it has a Q parameter that's somewhat above 1 on average, it means that if, so when Q is above 1, it means that you are, the disk is stable against Kraft-Natschnow collapse. And so when it's, say, globally above 1, you really need a turbulent, a significant density fluctuation so that locally you can trigger Kraft-Natschnow collapse. And so what stellar feedback does is that it tends to push it somewhat above 1, which makes the probability that a given turbulent fluctuation becomes self-gravitating just as small as it needs to be, so that the rate at which you form new stars is just what's needed to keep the disk in equilibrium. And if you, and in particular, if you did not have stellar feedback, the disk would convert stars, the gas and stars, much faster than that. So that's why the role of stellar feedback is to slow down star formation in that way. And the implication of that is that if you want to capture the essential physics of star formation in galaxies, in simulations, you actually don't have to resolve the formation of integral stars, but rather that the most important step is to resolve the formation of those most massive GMCs and to include the processes that regulate the rate at which new GMCs form, that is stellar feedback. In particular, what you do, if you do that, what you then do on scales much smaller than GMCs in terms of the small scale star formation prescription has a very weak impact on the global star formation properties of the galaxy. And that's something that we have verified explicitly in numerical simulations. Okay. So what I'll do in the interest of time is actually skip this section on black holes and go directly to the last part of this presentation, in which we're using this understanding of how star formation is regulated in galaxies and incorporating the key insights in numerical models that are allowing us to extend the predictions of that physical picture. Both to galaxies of different types, but also to a fully cosmological environment. Now, before I tell you about our new simulations, I just want to motivate a new project by comparing to what's been done to date in this field, the state of the art in cosmological simulations of galaxy formation. And here, the issue is that all numerical simulations have a finite resolution. And this has been a particular limitation for cosmological hydrodynamical simulations, because these are simulations in which we want to resolve the formation and evolution of galaxies. But we really haven't had the resolution typically to resolve the internal structure of galaxies. So that's why we've had to rely on significant sub-resolution assumptions for how star formation proceeds in galaxies, for how the interstellar media work, and for what the effects of feedback from stars and black holes are. And the type of approximations that have gone in these simulations include the following. So one thing that's often done is to actually prescribe the properties of the galactic outflows that we want in the simulation so as to match what's seen in observations, and to do that in a way that's well defined in terms of the velocity and mass loading of the outflows in the simulation, hydrodynamical interactions are actually temporally decoupled. That is, gas elements are taken from the interstellar media of simulated galaxies and kicked in an outflow with a prescribed velocity and mass loading factor. Another procedure that's commonly adopted when the hydrodynamical interactions are not decoupled altogether is to instead inject energy in the ISM of simulated galaxies as a proxy for the effect of supernovae. But because when you do that at finite resolution, the energy tends to be radiated away too efficiently, authors sometimes actually turn off the cooling temporally in the calculation so as to force the energy injection to have a dynamical impact on the simulated galaxies. And finally, most simulations of galaxy formation to date are focused on the effect of supernovae. That is, they have neglected other stellar feedback processes that we observe to be operating in the real universe and that are important in certain contexts, such as radiation pressure, photonization, and stellar winds. Now, because these approximations are somewhat ad hoc, they really have limited the predictive power of those simulations for essentially all the properties that are sensitive to star formation and stellar feedback. So essentially everything except perhaps large-scale structure in the universe. And so that's why those simulations have typically been actually tuned to reproduce certain calibration observables, such as the stellar mass function in galaxies. And this is just one example from a recent paper in which the galactic wind model was actually tuned to match the observed galaxy stellar mass function in the local universe, the different curves corresponding to different prescriptions that these authors have tried. Now, we know that this is a problematic, this is a problem for those, for the future of these calculations, because when you include only supernovae in this type of model, you actually have to ascribe to supernovae a total energy that's about five times what we believe real supernovae can actually provide. And furthermore, when procedures like turning off hydrodynamical interactions or turning off the cooling and the calculation are employed, it really corrupts the reliability with which the phase structure of galactic outflows that result can be predicted. And it also cast doubts on the accuracy with which the interaction of stellar feedback with the galaxy and the surrounding gas can be captured. And so our project really aims to move away from this type of ad hoc approximations and instead predict how star formation, how stellar feedback should occur and impact galaxy formation and evolution. So this project we call for feedback in realistic environments. And in this project, we also run cosmological hydrodynamical simulations, but we use a so-called zoom-in technique, and that's a technique in which we start with a large cosmological n-body run, which captures the large-scale torques on galaxies. But we concentrate all of our high-resolution hydrodynamical elements on one or a few dark matter halos of particular interest so that we can achieve a much higher resolution. And in particular, we use simulations in which we can resolve the formation of giant molecular clouds at all redshifts in our simulated galaxies, which is significant because those GMCs are, as I emphasized, are really the rate-limiting step for star formation. And in those calculations, we allow the gas to cool to molecular gas temperatures via a combination of metal line and molecular line emission. And we only allow star formation to proceed on small scales in self-gravitating clumps within GMCs. And simultaneously to that, we model the effects of stellar feedback processes by injecting momentum and energy where new stars are formed in a simulation following the properties of stellar population synthesis models, very importantly for all the main stellar feedback processes, that is including photonization, stellar winds, and radiation pressure, in addition to supernovae. So this is a movie of one of our early simulations from this project. It shows the gas density distribution in the calculation. Red traces hot gas, 1,000,000 degrees Kelvin or so. Green traces warm or cool gas, 10^4 degrees Kelvin or so. And purple traces molecular gas.
So you're doing something funny with visualization, right?
What do you mean by something
like
funny?
You're shining light on the pink stuff.
I'm actually not sure. Why are there different shades of purple? It traces a different. So the intensity traces conveys what the density is. I guess in this case, the column density because it's projected. And the color traces the temperature. And so there's a gradient in color because the molecular gas does not have a uniform temperature. It's between 10 to a few hundred degrees Kelvin. And so this simulated galaxy at redshift of zero lives in a dark matter halo that has a mass comparable the one that hosts our own Milky Way. And what's important in these calculations is that we really did not tune any of the parameters of our model a priori, as typically been done in the past. And in particular, properties like the star formation law or the Kennicott-Schmidt law that results in this calculation, or the galactic winds that are self-consistently generated, are really an outcome or prediction of the calculation rather than something that was put in by hand. So what we are now engaged in doing is comparing systematically the results of these calculations with a variety of observations to really test how well this model, our current best model for galaxy formation, is doing. So we are writing the first few papers from this project. The first one is a code comparison paper that compares two numerical methods for hydrodynamics in cosmology. One is an older implementation of SPH that's implemented in a very popular code called Gadget 2, and the one on the right, on the left-hand side, is an improved formulation of smooth particle hydrodynamics that really has resolved all the known historical discrepancies between SPH and grid-based code, something that has received a lot of attention in the literature recently. Our current simulated sample includes dwarf galaxies, Milky Way analogs like the one from the previous slide, and also galaxy groups. But this is a sample of simulated galaxies that we will expand very significantly over the next few years. These are some of the highest resolution simulations that have been run for each of these mass scales. In particular, our Milky Way analog simulations have a gas particle mass of about 7,000 solar masses and a softening length for the gravity acting on the gas that gets as small as 10 parsecs. So these are actually sufficient to resolve the formation of giant molecular clouds in the Milky Way, even at redshift of zero, where they are smallest. And one of our key early results is the one on the at the bottom here. So this is the predicted mass in stars in our simulated galaxies at redshift of zero as a function of mass of the dark matter halos that host them. Each of the points here is from one of our zoom-in simulations. And the solid cyan and magenta curves are observational inferences of the same quantity through abundance matching. And it is remarkable that without having tuned any parameters of the simulations, we actually can explain the suppression of the stellar mass of low mass galaxies that's illustrated here. So the dotted curve is again what you would have predicted absent stellar feedback if you had converted most of your gas mass in stars, whereas what's observed are the cyan and magenta curves, a factor of 100 to 1,000 times smaller than that for low mass galaxies. That's something that's naturally predicted by our simulations that includes known stellar feedback processes. Another thing that I have been particularly interested in is to use spectroscopic measurements of the gas around galaxies as a probe of how galaxies acquire the gas and also the galactic winds that they drive. So these are observations that are being pursued by a number of groups, both at low redshift, but also in this case at high redshift, redshift of 3. The left-hand side is a calculation that I did a few years ago in which I predicted the column density of neutral hydrogen around star-forming galaxies, so-called Lyman-Bragg galaxies, at this redshift. The dashed curve in these panels indicate the virial radius of the dark matter halos. And the yellow and red material here traced filaments of accreting cool gas from the intergalactic medium that really ultimately fuels star formation in galaxies. And this was a calculation before we had the stellar feedback model that I just described. And on the right-hand side is a new calculation from exactly the same initial conditions, but in which we included our full stellar feedback model, which self-consistently drives galactic wind. And you can see that the covering factor of a cool, dense gas has significantly increased, and in fact, it is bringing those calculations in significantly better agreement with observations than what we had found previously. And one of the actually recent observational puzzles to address over the next few years is the fact that while around ordinary star-forming galaxies, star-formation-driven galactic winds appear to be sufficient to observe, to explain the observed cool gas in halos that are only slightly more massive, but that have luminous black holes at the center, so quasar-hosting halos, the covering factor of cool gas is actually a factor of 2 to 3 higher, something that we actually have not seen in calculations that include only stellar feedback. And so one of the avenues for the future is for us to understand to what degree feedback from black holes, in addition to from star formation, might be needed to explain this cool gas in massive halos at higher shift. Like I said, this is a large project. It's an ongoing one. And because these simulations are really significantly more predictive than what had been done before, this is allowing us to both revisit many of the classical questions in galaxy formation and also intergalactic medium science, as well as address some new ones. And so we have collaborators that are now joining our project and analyzing our simulations following their own science interests to revisit these questions, including the properties of gas and galactic halos in all phases, including inflows and outflows, in particular to develop observational diagnostics to probe these processes, how heavy elements are dispersed in the universe by galactic winds and other processes, how different stellar populations are assembled. For example, what is the origin of stellar bulges in galaxies, whether these are predominantly built up by mergers or secular processes over longer timescales. Really, a new set of questions that we can think about addressing with these simulations is actually the formation and evolution of star clusters, because in previous cosmological simulations, the ISM really was not resolved, and so star formation proceeded very smoothly in galactic disk. Whereas now that we resolve the bird clouds of stars, we also are simultaneously resolving the formation of star clusters, and we can think about tracing the evolution in time and relating them, for instance, to observe globular clusters. one of our collaborators, Jose Onorbe, is looking at the impact that stellar feedback has on the density profiles of dark matter halos in the center, the so-called cusp core transformation problem. And one of the key problems in galaxy formation that we want to use these simulations to study is, like I mentioned, the quenching of star formation in galaxies significantly more massive than the Milky Way, as something that black hole feedback may play a role in. And so one of the things we want to do is actually also include stellar black hole feedback in these calculations. So I think I'll just stop here and take questions. Yes?
I heard talked a couple of years ago by Archibald Socrates about
cosmic rays.
Cosmic ray feedback, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so it has not been included in our calculations. That's something we would like to explore in the future. But I can make a few comments, in particular because there have been new papers submitted on this over the past several months. And so what we know from our calculation is that if you include only these other stellar feedback processes, supernovae, photonization, stellar winds, and radiation pressure, then we can explain the suppression of the galaxy stellar mass function at the low mass end reasonably well. In other words, cosmic rays do not appear to be needed by these observations alone. Though we know in the Milky Way that a third or so of the pressure in the interstellar medium comes from cosmic rays. And so they certainly are not completely negligible. And what recent papers that have included cosmic rays find is that they can indeed drive significant galactic outflows, and at least in dwarf galaxies, can also explain reasonably the suppression of the stellar mass. Now, it is also the case that those calculations have been incomplete in the sense that while they have included cosmic rays, they have neglected many of these other processes which we do include. And so one thing that we don't yet understand is when you put everything together, how do they interact? And either suppress or reinforce one another. And then the other thing is that the way that cosmic rays have been included in these calculations to date is quite uncertain. In particular, one has to understand how cosmic rays diffuse in the interstellar medium of galaxies, and that we, I would argue, we don't understand very well. So those calculations have assumed a certain value for the diffusion coefficient of cosmic rays. And the fact that or the galactic winds that result in these calculations are dependent on what that assumption is. So I think the bottom line is that it's plausible that cosmic rays play a role that is comparable in importance to the other stellar feedback processes that we have included. It's unlikely that they are much more effective than those processes because we can explain most of the observations without them. But it's a very interesting set of questions to pursue.
One of the slides here, you showed that in the small scale supersonic flows can be destructive in the star formation, right? So I wonder that if we have supersonic flow gas, that plays another way that should increase the star formation because it produces the shock wave and then
yeah, produces density. Yeah.
Density. Yeah.
I think that's right. So the one thing that I will say is that so there are theories that explain the slow star formation rate in galaxies based on the small-scale properties of turbulence, but I actually believe that these are both ruled out by numerical simulations as well as by observations, like I mentioned. And so I will not defend those theories. Let's see if I can. Support what I mean by that. Okay. So let me, I'll say a few more words about those supersonic turbulence theories. So what those supersonic turbulent theories are is is the following. So in those theories, the small value of epsilon free fall is identified with the instantaneous mass fraction in supersonically turbulent gas that is in at densities that are sufficiently high to be self-gravitating. And for driven isothermal turbulence without self-gravity, so under idealized conditions, that density PDF is very nearly log normal, and that mass fraction can be calculated as a function of Mach number of the turbulence. And what these authors did is exactly that calculation, and they showed that that mass fraction is of order 1%, and it varies very weakly with Mach number of the turbulence. So that is why those theories predict that the epsilon free fall number is a nearly universal constant. And notice that this is very different from the picture that I advocated today, because it's one that really appeals to the small scale properties of the turbulence, whereas the role of the turbulence in our theory was really to prevent gravitational collapse on the largest scales in the galaxy. Now, I think this argument actually does not is not correct, and it is not correct because when you include self-gravity, it is not true that the density PDF is a nice log normal. So without self-gravity, what you get is this dotted black curve. It's a log normal. It's also traced by the red curve here, the no gravity curve. But when you turn on self-gravity, what happens is that you develop very strong parallel tails, and that's a signature of runaway gravitational collapse. And so when you turn on self-gravity, even if you continuously stir the box, you can get runaway star formation. And the star formation efficiency per free fall time not only can achieve a value that's much above 1%, but it's also time dependent. It tends to increase with time. And the regions that are self-gravitating really are created by a combination of shocks in the turbulence, like you mentioned. And so some of these regions really are self-gravitating because the turbulence exists. And then that's accelerated by the fact that self-gravity amplifies density peaks that are formed in that way. Yes?
So most of the black hole mass in the universe are not in supermassive black holes, they are in stellar black holes.
Is that right? Okay.
By a factor of 10 to 100. And
okay.
And many black holes come in binaries.
Yes.
And many stars come in binaries.
Yes.
Presumably some of them would come some of them would survive, some of the companions. And we know that there are X-ray binaries basically so there's a black hole that's accreting mass from its companion. So there could be feedback basically to that.
Yes.
So why doesn't anybody talk about it?
So there have been a few papers written about this, especially in the context of hydrogen ionization. And so like cosmic rays, that's something that is potentially important, but it has been, and so that's something that's worth working on. But the uncertainties, I would argue, are greater than, say, for supernova feedback, just because binary evolution is more complicated. And so I would say that we just don't have as good of an understanding for what the impact is. But that's also something we'd like to look into.
Okay, perhaps we can stop there and thank you for that.
Thank you.